The Takeaway is supported by Netflix original documentary series Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On, from Rashida Jones, Jill Bauer, and Ronna Gratis. The series explores sex and technology in a digital age. Hot Girls Wanted, Turned On is now streaming only on Netflix.
Hey, The Takeaway needs your help. Please visit wnyc.podcastingsurvey.com and tell us a little bit about you and the podcast you love in a 5-minute anonymous survey. Knowing more about you helps us make more of the shows you enjoy. Thank you from all of us at The Takeaway. And now, this is The Takeaway for Tuesday, April 25th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry, coming to you today from WBFO in Buffalo, New York. Thank you for joining us from this city of hard steel, Great Lakes. Buffalo is America's suburb of Canada. That's right. It really is. Everyone here has dual nationality, right? I used to hitchhike to Buffalo as a teenager, and then I'd buy a Greyhound bus pass and go from Buffalo through Canada to Detroit. My adventure days, back when I was walking around. Now I'm just another New York City slicker visiting a community that's had a few golden ages, but looks to be making a turnaround here in this community, and more about that tomorrow on the show. But how do you signify Buffalo? I mean, I look for Buffalo songs and booster jingles, and they're all pretty dreadful. So at the risk of offending folks who are tired of just another New York Cityite defining Buffalo, I could only really justify this classic from the musical 42nd Street, but here goes. You know this one. To Niagara in the sleeper, there's no honeymoon, it's cheaper, and the train goes slow. Off, we're gonna shuffle, shuffle off to Buffalo. You know it, come on.
For a little silver quarter, we can have the Pullman Porter turn the lights down low. Oh, we're gonna shuffle, shuffle off to Buffalo.
Not so bad. But to the business at hand.
I will work with Congress to introduce the following broader legislative measures and fight for their passage within the first 100 days of my administration.
I've got to say, what does 100 days mean when evaluating a president? We've heard a lot about that 100 days. The Trump administration still has 4 days left on this 100-day ticket. How will Trump do compared with how the president has billed these first days of his administration? He said back in October, while on the campaign trail in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, that he'd clean up corruption and collusion in Washington, ways to protect American workers. He'd restore the Constitution. There'd be a middle-class tax relief and simplification act. He'd ditch Obamacare. It's not quite working out as planned, but the 100 days marker is not in the Constitution. Where did it come from? For that, we've got some historians. Julian Zelizer is a political historian at Princeton University. His latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now. Lyndon Johnson, Congress and the Battle for the Great Society. And Alexis Coe is an author, historian, and host of the podcast Presidents Are People Too. She's currently working on a biography of George Washington and says there's a lot of history around the 100 days.
The 100 days came from FDR, 32nd president, who comes into office in 1933, and we're 4 years into a depression. Banks are failing. There are lines to withdraw money that's not there around the block. There's widespread loss of confidence in the American government. And so FDR comes into office and he starts just throwing things against the wall to see what sticks. And not everything does, but he has some real successes. Now, historians are still debating whether we can thank FDR or World War II, but he did bond with the nation in a way that was fairly unprecedented with his fireside chats and his speeches, not just people who came to his rallies, who registered online. So this idea of unity, which presidents since the very beginning, since George Washington, have been, you know, going for, he definitely established, and with good nature.
Julian Zelizer, we've seen down through history that big presidents will start a tradition that is very memorable, but then it gets repeated over and over again, and in some ways might become a little bit mindless. I think the State of the Union address was originally just a memo to Congress. It's anything but that now. Is the 100 days in danger of becoming this mindless ritual?
Well, it is a ritual. It's an artificial marker. FDR set the standard, and since then, every president has been measured against that. There's many presidents who don't have great first 100 days, but go on to be relatively or very significant presidents. Many legislative achievements come much later in a presidency. So someone like Bill Clinton didn't have a particularly memorable or successful first 100 days, but went on to win re-election, went on to be immensely popular, and certainly considered one of the most important Democrats of recent decades. And at the same time, I remember when I was writing about Jimmy Carter, it was striking at the end of his 100 days, the press was saying he was doing fantastic, that it was very successful, and he went on to be a one-term president. So it's both this ritual we keep doing, and I am not convinced it's the best way, really, to evaluate what's going to happen to a presidency. It just gives us an early feel for how the political style of a president will shake out and the relationship with Congress.
Donald Trump passed 28 laws as of day 90, executive orders 24, but approval rating is down in the 40s. President Obama passed 11 laws, 19 executive orders, 65% approval rating, which is pretty high. That's up in the Carter zone there at the end of the first 100 days. And he had a very, very hefty legislative success rate there in the first 100 days. Bill Clinton passed 24 laws, 13 executive orders, 55% was the approval rating. Alexis Coe, did these numbers evaluate the president, or is it more the president's ability to work with Congress? It's kind of an evaluation of the working quality of the government itself.
Right. And that's why FDR was so successful. And going back to what Julian was talking about, that this is this arbitrary number. The thing about it is, yes, FDR was the progenitor, and that made sense given the country he inherited. And we definitely have to remember that a lot of presidents inherited crises, including Obama, the greatest recession, FDR, you know, the Great Depression, Truman, the end of World War II, Ford, Watergate, you know, we can go on and on. But the thing that keeps the 100 days alive is the media. I mean, it's nice. It's a nice little soundbite. It is a nice organizing tool. But the thing that keeps it going is definitely the media. And I think a good indicator of the relationship between usually the president and the media as far as the 100 days is when George W. Bush invited the media on the 100th day to have lunch at the White House because he had not accomplished that much. And that's someone who, again, the presidency, the first 100 days didn't look like it was, going to be much. And then it really was. But that happened after the first 100 days.
What do you think, Alexis, Donald Trump will say about this 100 days?
They were fantastic. They were the best ever. The hyperbole will be incredible. But I mean, I would counter that the best 100 days ever were actually far before FDR, and it's anachronistic to even call them that. But I mean, George Washington's first 100 days were pretty incredible. He established the presidency.
And LBJ's first 100 days after the assassination of JFK, which is a different kind of measure, Julian, was also over the top.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the two big bills before he is reelected in 1964, the Civil Rights Act of 64, which is just, it's not just another bill, it's just not just another number of legislation. It's a signature achievement in race relations after Reconstruction. And he also pushes through a historic tax cut. And all of this is moving instantly. LBJ, he didn't believe in the 100 days, meaning that it's a finite period. But he did really believe that presidents just have a limited amount of time. He wasn't a believer, ironically, in presidential power. So for him, what this early window, whatever you wanted to call it, meant was this is the window before Congress really turns against you, even in a period of united government. So he moved on those two bills after his reelection in 1964. He does the same thing. He just floods Congress with ideas such as Medicare and Medicaid. He'll go with voting rights and education policy and much more. So he is more on the FDR side of the ledger, meaning a president who really pushes through transformative legislation. But look at the outcome. Again, he had very good 100 days, but he didn't have a very good end to the presidency. Big mistakes were made after the 100 days were over, and Vietnam is the name of that mistake.
There are some presidents who really blew it in the first 100 days, even though they weren't measuring what went on. I mean, Benjamin Harrison, of course, didn't make it to the 100 days.
Should have worn a coat.
Yeah, exactly. He died of pneumonia. Everybody knows that. Are you going to finish your book in 100 days?
Oh, I wish. No, it's due in January. Thank goodness. I do think it's important to look at some of the failures that Trump has had in the first 100 days. And again, that can change. The Affordable Care Act, he vowed to repeal it and rewrite it, and that didn't even get to a final vote, but it seems like we haven't heard the last of that. There are still sub-cabinet positions to be appointed. There's no detailed budget proposal, and that's usually in by this time. You know, the immigration ban, he issued it, it was blocked, he rewrote it, it was blocked. We have to look at this, though, and say, like, right now we know that he has the majority in both houses, and he still hasn't gotten a lot done.
Julian Zeller, your final thoughts?
Yeah, he hasn't gotten a lot of done. We've seen problems. But I would just say there are some ways in which he can say he's successful, kind of a blitz of executive power to deregulate industry, to deregulate energy markets. He's staffed his cabinets with people who are very aggressively going to try to undercut the programs they run. And finally, even though his national approval ratings are very bad, what he cares about is the base of support and feeding that kind of partisan anger in the electorate. And there his support remains quite strong.
Good points. I was also counting you. You did that in under 100 seconds. So Julian Zeller, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
Julian Zeller is a political historian at Princeton University. His latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. Alexis Koh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Author, historian, host of the podcast Presidents Are People Too. She's currently working on a biography of George Washington.
My pledge is that in the first 100 days of my administration...
Today marks our 100th day of working together for the American people.
100 days since I took the oath of office.
What follows is my 100-day action plan to make America great again.
100 days, 100 nights, to know a man's heart.
So what could you accomplish in 100 days? The space station could do 1,600 orbits of the Earth in that time. A cow can produce 650 gallons of milk. Impressive. Alexis Koh could never finish her Washington biography in 100 days, she says. But Speedy Jack Kerouac could have written On the Road three times. Same with Anthony Burgess in A Clockwork Orange. Some of you kind of like this 100-day marker.
This is Pam Roberts from Brookline, Massachusetts. Right off the bat, a president sets the tone for his or her term. 100 days is ample, important time to establish how she or he will advance the causes of the people of this country and the world, as well as lay out a plan for the protection of our resources.
Hey, this is James from Anchorage, Alaska. People look for metrics, benchmarks, statistics, poll numbers. But how did that work for Hillary Rodham Clinton in the election? Days 101 through 2920 are just as important as days 1 through 100.
My name is Sherry. I'm calling from Queens, New York. I haven't necessarily thought the first 100 days were crucial, but this president has changed my way of thinking. With all the promises made and virtually nothing accomplished, I hope the president has realized just how over his head he is.
What do you think of the first 100 days? Good measure? Arbitrary measure? What's your policy priority in 100 days? Tell us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or join the conversation on the Takeaways Facebook page.
The Takeaway is supported by Staples, offering copy and print solutions for business materials printed in-store or ordered online, including business cards, presentations, large banners, and posters. More at Staples and Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting today from the studios of WNED and WBFO in Buffalo, New York. Nestled here by the inland sea of Lake Erie, part of the much larger Great Lakes system, which stretches from Lake Superior and Duluth to Lake Michigan and Chicago to Detroit on Lake Huron, Cleveland and Toledo, back to Buffalo, continuing along the St. Lawrence Seaway all the way to the Atlantic Ocean. Big cities, big industry, big pollution problems means big cleanup problems, and there are worries as people in this region look at the Trump budget proposal released earlier this year, where the president calls for steep cuts to the EPA and other agencies charged with protecting the environment, cuts that could amount to a loss of $300 million in annual funding for cleanup of the Great Lakes. The region and its mighty lakes supply 46 million jobs and make up roughly 28% of combined U.S. and Canadian economic activity. Dave Rosenthal is the managing editor for Great Lakes Today, and he's been following this very, very closely. Dave, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me on, John.
So the Great Lakes are great, but the restoration project is also a huge deal from here on the eastern side all the way to the western side. What's at stake here if the budget gets zeroed out at the EPA?
Well, there are lots of things that people are worried about here. Part of it is the cuts to the EPA because people wonder if they'll be able to enforce the clean air and water regulations. They're also worried about space programs that give us climate change information. But as you mentioned, the big one is this $300 million a year, which funds lots of different projects all around the region. All these areas have been degraded by industrial development over the years, and people see that the restoration, this $300 million, is a way to restore the lakes and also bring back the economy here. It gives us sort of a second chance after the industry left from the big Rust Belt days. It's a second chance now to sort of turn the economy around.
Tell me about the linkage between the lakes and the economy now, because we all remember the sort of Edmund Fitzgerald, the iron freighters, and the shipping traffic on the lakes, which is the traditional notion of its economic value. But there's a lot a different notion of that today.
Yeah, one good example is you take the Buffalo River, which was a river that was declared dead. It runs through Buffalo into Lake Erie, and it had been sort of a dumping ground for industry, like Muskegon Lake and a lot of other areas all
Cuyahoga
around.
Cuyahoga in Cleveland.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. Right. It's very similar, like from any city, Toledo, Cleveland. Now they've restored them. They've cleaned up a lot of the sediment, a lot of the pollution, and it's brought back development along the shoreline. So now if you drive down the Buffalo River, you see new apartments going up. You see a beautiful bar where you can take boats and dock there. And
so it's really bringing back a quality of life residential and development asset as opposed to an industrial asset.
Right. And I think that's why it's attracting bipartisan support. It's one of the few things in Washington that Democrats and Republicans can agree on now is that this money is really crucial to the Great Lakes.
What is the scale of the Great Lakes? Remind us again. I mean, this is a huge, huge system of fresh water.
Yeah, exactly. There are 30 million people around the lake, so it's about a tenth of the United States population. For the water itself as a resource, it's 20% of the world's fresh water. And when you think about the future, you know, if water becomes really a scarce resource in this country and around the world, the lakes are going to be more and more important.
What's the consensus among political leaders around this region regarding the cleanup and the maintenance of the federal support for restoration? And what do they tell you?
I mean, I think they're very confident that they can restore some of the money in Congress. Again, losing $300 million a year for over several years is a big haul to get that back. So in the Buffalo region, for example, there's a congressman, Brian Higgins, in the city who's a Democrat, very supportive of it. There's a congressman in the suburbs, a Republican, Chris Collins, also very supportive of it. And that's very unusual to see them on the same page of an issue.
Lena Pollack, who's the U.S. chair of the International Joint Commission, this is the institution which regulates the whole regional water system. Pollack says that we run the risk of losing the progress that's been made even in the last few years.
Old, historic, highly contaminated areas that take millions of dollars to clean up after the fact. And in truth, they were identified back in the late 80s, and very little had been done between then and the more recent years, and the last 3 years have seen good progress. There's still probably about 80% of the work to be done in the next couple of decades. Takes a long time once you've messed something up to unmess it.
80% of the work that needs to be done. Here's Jill Jedlicka, who's executive director of the Buffalo Niagara Riverkeeper, who really sort of states what the principle is here and what people are hoping continues.
Ultimately, we need to connect people to water emotionally, physically. all these other components, teaching our youth about understanding the water science, understanding how our systems work. They are the stewards of the future. And if we don't invest in them now, we're gonna have challenges moving forward.
That really doesn't sound like the rhetoric coming out of Washington right now. Do they get it on Capitol Hill, as far as you can tell, reporting this?
I think the region's representatives get it. The senators and the congressmen from this region, they certainly get it. The question is, can they transfer that feeling to the other members of Congress? I mean, it's a big block of representatives from this region because it's a big part of the country. But will they be able to horse trade or, you know, make everyone aware that this is such a big problem? And one of the issues is, I think if you're not from the Great Lakes, you don't really understand the Great Lakes. I mean, I came here from Baltimore, and I can tell you people down there have no idea how big and how important and how beautiful it is as a region. So I think the folks in Washington have some convincing to do.
All right. Dave Rosenthal is managing editor of Great Lakes Today. Dave, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. We've discussed this week about how the president wants his border wall more than anything else, and it might have slowed down the negotiations on a bipartisan spending bill. And, you know, there's a deadline, midnight on April 28th.
The president has made very clear that he's got two priorities in this continuing resolution. Number one, the increase in funding for the military. Number two, for our homeland and border security and the wall.
Sean Spicer at the White House press briefing yesterday, he added that he was quite confident that a deal would be reached by the Friday deadline. Kyle Dropp is co-founder and chief research officer of Morning Consult. He's led a series of polls on how Americans view the budget, view government shutdowns, and how they affect future elections. He joins me now. Kyle, welcome.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So do you think Americans care about the wall? They're willing to wager a government shutdown on this?
Well, nobody wants a shutdown. Now, this is the same for elites, and it's the same for the thousands of people that we've interviewed in our polls. For instance, a few weeks ago, two-thirds of Americans said that the government should do everything it can to stop the shutdown. We asked people if certain policies were worthy of sort of standing up for a shutdown, and about 4 in 10 Americans said that border wall funding was something that was important to them, and they would be okay with a shutdown if there was not border wall funding. That's just about 4 in 10 in Americans. A majority of Republicans held that position.
And let's look at the question of, do people want what the administration wants? He's got, you know, control of both houses of Congress. You would think that the Trump administration could do whatever it wants, regardless of the polls. Do you see a disconnect?
Well, I would say that in general, provisions such as, you know, support for a border wall or provisions to expand military spending, which is another thing that the administration would like, or to increasingly secure our border, are generally popular. Now, in some of the Morning Consult political polls that we've done in the past, voters don't prioritize border wall spending. They put fighting ISIS and they put other economic considerations such as job creation even higher than provisions to support a border wall. You know, looking back a little bit at the 2013 shutdown and who was blamed for that, voters sort of spread it around. About half blamed Republicans. About 3 in 10, though, blamed the Obama administration. And we're seeing that same dynamic in the Morning Consult political polling. We asked just last week if there was a government shutdown, who would be blamed? About half of voters said the Trump administration or congressional Republicans, but fully a third said the Democrats. That has to do a little bit with the polarization in the American electorate. That is, you know, voters not willing to say or that the other side is doing something right and generally siding, you know, with their political party.
Well, it may be allegiance, but, you know, it's not wrong if the Democrats are, you know, threatening to filibuster or are going to take a hard line on some administration positions, which, you know, certainly Chuck Schumer in the Senate has done.
I think that's right. Unlike 1995, 96 and 2013, the Republicans currently have control of the House, the Senate and the presidency, and leading Democrats are saying as much. So, you know, their hope is that, you know, the blame lies on Republicans if there is a shutdown of any sorts. Now, that remains to be seen. You know, if you recall the October 2013 shutdown, then just 13 months later, Republicans picked up about 10 seats in the Senate. They picked up more than a dozen seats in the House, and they even picked up governorship. So I think the leading explanations for that are that voters' memories can be relatively short. And then, you know, blame is spread around. It's not that 100% of Democrats are going to go and they may actually blame Republicans rather than be more divided.
Kyle Dropp is co-founder and chief research officer of Morning Consult. He's led a series of polls on how Americans view government shutdowns and how the deal-making may be driven by polls. Kyle, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you for having me.
In Arkansas last night, Jack Harold Jones, 52, died at 7:20 p.m. Central Daylight Time after authorities administered a lethal injection 14 minutes earlier. Fellow death row inmate Marcel Wayne Williams, 46, was pronounced dead just over 3 hours later at 10:33 p.m. According to officials at the Commons Unit Prison, about 75 miles southeast of the state capital, Little Rock. Two executions accelerated among eight that the state had planned in 11 days this month before its supplies of the controversial sedative midazolam expire. However, a court order has placed a stay of execution for four of the inmates. It's been a tough week in Arkansas. Monitoring all of this is Tom Mayer, deputy managing editor at the Marshall Project, and the website The Next to Die, which tracks scheduled executions across the country.
Last night was the first time in more than 16 years that a state has carried out two executions on the same day. There was first Jack Jones's execution happened in Arkansas that went relatively quickly in terms of appeals. But then after he was executed, the attorneys for Marcel Williams, who was due to be up about an hour and a half later, filed an emergency motion with the federal court saying that there had been some problems with Jack Jones's death that delayed things for a little over an hour and a half as a judge held an emergency hearing to determine what had happened in Jones's execution. Had something gone wrong? She had an emergency phone hearing with attorneys for the appellant and for the state, but ultimately permitted it to go forward. And later that night, the second execution went through.
And what's the feeling among lawyers trying to stop this process? And what's the feeling on death row as far as you can tell? I know you're in touch with individuals, one of whom is going to be executed on Thursday.
I mean, I think there was some feeling earlier last week as there was a number of executions that were stopped by appeals. And then I think some of the optimism might have seeped out of the anti-capital punishment community as the Supreme Court voted in a split vote not to stay one of the executions Monday. When that went through, then last night's appeals, at least from what we can see in court filings, were less voluminous than we'd seen in some of the earlier cases.
They were Hail Marys.
It certainly seemed that way. Yeah, I believe last week there were at least seven filings to the Supreme Court.
Any sense of what's going on death row? I mean, this accelerated rate of executions must chill things on an already chilly death row in Arkansas.
Yeah, one would think so. One of the men, Kenneth Williams, who's scheduled to be executed on Thursday, has written for the Marshall Project and talked a little bit about this. He has been through this more than once before, getting an execution date and talking about sort of the process one goes through dealing with this. He has not talked a lot about how his fellow death row prisoners are dealing with it, but he sort of explained that, you know, why he went through the clemency process and what he knows about the execution drugs, sort of what he's expecting in the last days leading up to his execution.
To do this just so quickly for this arbitrary reason just feels like the system isn't working. It just feels like another feature in the criminal justice system that just is unworkable. And I don't know.
Well, there is some of those arguments have been made by the U.S. Supreme Court justices in this case, wondering why is there a rush now? Why is it essential to push all of these through in such a short period of time when there are still some of these questions of innocence, of due process, of representation before those get heard out. But those justices were in the minority. There were only four of them that wanted to stop Liddell Lee's execution last Thursday. And last night, in some of their dissents, not granting a stay for Jack Jones, they said, you know, we would grant this stay for the same reason that we've brought up in previous cases here. But they're in the minority at the moment.
What's next, Tom?
Next is on Thursday. There's one more execution due to be held in Arkansas. And after that, they are out of the drugs. And the question is whether they would be able to attain them again.
Tom Mayer is deputy managing editor at the Marshall Project on the website The Next to Die, which tracks scheduled executions across the country. Thanks so much, Tom.
Thank you.
The difficulty of registering political dissent has been part of our conversation this week. Yesterday, it was increasingly repressive Egypt. Today, we go to Russia and Chechnya, where reports of brutal torture and killing in Chechnya have increased. The target, gay men. Officials have maintained this is untrue and that homosexuality, quote, doesn't exist in Chechnya, an indication of the level of intolerance of the LGBT community. Olga Sadovskaya is deputy chair of the Committee Against Torture, a human rights organization providing psychological and legal assistance to torture victims in Russia. And Olga is part of a SWAT team of lawyers, actually, that sends three different lawyers to different regions of Chechnya every month to investigate and document human rights abuses and to keep the authorities guessing.
So we show to the authorities that we have a lot of faces, hundreds of faces who are investigating the crimes. And there is not only one people who can be arrested or killed to stop this activity, because you can't kill 100 people. It's always a question of the price you pay, because even if you kill human rights defender, it becomes expensive from the perspective of your image on the international and national arena. So it's much more expensive to you to kill 100 human rights defenders than to kill one.
Safety in numbers, an intelligence strategy, but lots more work to be done.
We have decrease in respect for human rights. We have a lot of new restricting laws that forbid peaceful public movements, that forbids demonstrations, that puts ban on foreign funding for human rights NGOs and for social NGOs. So we're witnessing the shrinking space for human society, for civil society, for human rights.
Why do people tolerate that shrinking of concern for human rights? Is it because they're scared? Is it because they're...
I think it's because the governments actually scare people, because the governments try to explain that the more respect for human rights people have, the more problematic it becomes in regarding the security of the state. They put the controversy between the human rights and the state security. If you want your state to be secure, you have to betray a little bit human rights.
Which is exactly what the U.S. was told after 9/11. We've got to be tough.
Absolutely.
We've got to waterboard what was talked about during the campaign. We've got to embrace torture.
But it doesn't work that way. Torture is mainly justified by this type of explanation. There is a simple question that people are asked. If you know that this person is a terrorist, if you know that he has put a bomb somewhere, can we torture his terrorist to find out where the bomb is or what he's going to do the next as his terrorist attacked? And the majority of people tend to answer yes, you can torture him to find a solution to the situation, to prevent damage, to prevent deaths. So these things happen. But as we see, it's not effective.
Who's getting that message? Who's formulating that message best? And how is it working in Russia?
Well, in Russia, there is a very big problem with the independent source of information. The internet is still more or less independent, but when it comes to TV, to radio, we don't have really independent media in the country. So you have to approach people somehow. Human rights defenders are not the most effective people to work with the media because we don't have skills for that, but we try to cooperate with the commercials, with the independent media from other countries. We have to speak to people. We have to talk to people as much as you can. Everybody should.
You have been doing this a long time. I sense a frustration with just how bad human rights groups tend to be in getting the message out. Yeah. What do you think should happen?
I think we should also approach the people who are doing business, because you have to explain to them that if you want to do the business in the country, you also have to support the human rights, because human rights, it's not something that is for people, for asylum seekers or for someone. Human rights is about the rule of law. If human rights doesn't exist in the country, it means that the rule of law doesn't work there. If the rule of law doesn't work there, it means that you don't have legal protection for your own assets.
Do you know what you could say tomorrow in your home office that would get you arrested?
Well, it can happen.
Anytime.
Anytime, yeah. there were a lot of attempts to stop us. Our office in Chechnya was attacked several times and burned for two times and ruined for two times as well. Last year, it was actually an anniversary on the March of 9th, a press tour that we organized to... We brought several Russian and foreign journalists to Chechnya to show the situation in the region. The bus was attacked and burned down, all the bus. All the people were traumatized. Everybody was seriously beaten. The equipment was destroyed. So it can happen. It's a question of your personal security and safe.
This faith in documentation of human rights abuses, whether we're talking about Syria or Chechnya or places in Russia, Africa, the assumption is that if you document that it's going to move people. But what's to say it doesn't just end up in piles of archives that no one pays any attention to? I was at an exhibit at the United Nations with the worst possible pictures of torture in Syria. And, people walk by it on their way to work, paying no attention whatsoever.
There are two aims. Either you want to bring attention to the situation and you have to make people believe that it is the truth, so you have to document it to show that you're not lying to the people. And another issue is that you're documenting the crimes now, but they can be used afterwards. There is international trial on former Yugoslavia. It happened more than 20 years after the crimes were committed. But if those documents, if those evidences were not documented that time 20 years ago, nothing would happen now.
Patience, trust.
And work.
Faith in the future and work. Mm-hmm. Finally, people have a sense that everyone is violating human rights.
Yeah.
It's not just
yeah.
the government. It's the terrorists and the government, and there's no solution. How do you get out of that cycle, that circle?
We need reforms, actually. The only thing is that the law should be working properly and the law should be adequate. And we have to fight for that. We have to fight for normal laws. We have to fight for normal and adequate law enforcement practice. We have to fight for independent investigations. We have to fight for independent media that provides information on independent investigations to the public. We have a lot of things to fight for.
Olga, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Olga Sadovskaya is deputy chair of the Committee Against Torture, a human rights organization providing legal assistance to victims in Russia. We spoke to Olga as part of our look at dissent in different parts of the world, thanks to the Bernstein Institute for Human Rights at NYU Law School and their annual symposium, Defending Dissent, for connecting us with Olga and others.
One of the fundamental things of murder, one of the elements, is that somebody has to be killed.
So when a murder is discovered not to be a murder, what then? Especially when someone is serving a life sentence for a crime that now doesn't exist based on some new evidence. For this week's Case in Point, we learn of Jesse McKim of Missouri, who is serving a life sentence without parole for murdering a woman in 1999. There have been questions about this case all along, but in 2013 it was determined that the woman McKim allegedly killed seems to have actually died due to a meth overdose. When confronted with this new circumstance, the judge denied McKim's request for relief because, quote, he had not conclusively proved his innocence. Is that the way it's supposed to work? Jennifer Bukowski is an attorney in Columbia, Missouri, who's been working on Jesse McKim's case for years. She's with Andrew Cohen, senior editor at the Marshall Project, and our Case in Point guru, whose voice you heard a moment ago. He says this case seems to violate a basic legal principle.
There has to be some nefarious killing that takes place. And if you don't have that, then you're not going to be able to convince any judge, much less a jury, of convicting someone. And so what happened in this case is there was this initial finding that strangulation may have been the cause of death. Everyone ran with it back in 1997, 1998, 1999. A man was convicted and sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole. And it turns out that the victim in the case probably wasn't strangled at all. Instead, died of methamphetamine overdose after some sort of a binge over 3 days before the end of her life. And if you take away the homicide component to a murder case, you really aren't supposed to have a murder case.
Jennifer, how did you find this case?
I'm a practicing attorney in Columbia, Missouri, and I received an unsolicited letter from a prisoner asking for help. And that in and of itself isn't that unusual for me to get these kind of requests. But enclosed with it was a letter from the medical examiner of the county that I practice in that I had cross-examined in my first murder trial 2 years earlier and who I had seen called by our prosecutor's office in every murder and manslaughter case in our county. In his letter, he said it was certain beyond a reasonable doubt that justice was not done here, and he implored the AG to reopen this case to take a look at it. That was something completely out of the ordinary, unlike anything I'd received before.
So the defendant you might have been skeptical of without some other information, but this medical examiner letter really said this needs to be looked at.
Right. And since I knew this medical examiner, it really stood out to me as something I should just do a little bit more investigation into. And once I did, it was so immediately clear that a terrible mistake had been made and an injustice was ongoing here with the imprisonment of this man for a murder that never even happened.
So, Jennifer, how many minutes did it take then for Mr. McKim to be released?
He's still in prison. As of April 14th, he's been in prison for 20 years for a murder that never occurred. And I've been working on this case. It'll be 5 years later this year that I've been working on trying to win his freedom. At the time I first took the case, I naively believed it would only take 10 to 20 hours of my time to convince the powers to be to let him out on the grounds that he was obviously actually innocent. But that turns out not to be the case.
Well, what's the argument keeping him locked up?
It depends on what stage of litigation at the, trial court level where we did the habeas evidentiary hearing. The AG came up with this kind of dubious theory without any supporting evidence that, well, even if she overdosed on meth, then he must have injected her involuntarily with meth, and so he still caused her death and he should still die in prison as a result. The problem is, if you look at the jury instruction, which is one of the first things I did when I took this case, the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt that my client or his co-defendant caused this woman's death by suffocating her. The whole theory of the state's case at trial centered around my client having special knowledge of the cause of death being suffocation that only the real killer would know. So we know what the jury found beyond a reasonable doubt is wrong and that she died of an overdose. And also both the attorneys on both sides agree that she was binging for days on meth that she herself cooked.
Andrew Cohen, why is it possible for judges to inject a notion of Mr. McKim has to conclusively prove his innocence to be exonerated here, or a attorney general or a prosecutor injecting this theory of the drug being injected by the defendant when in court that would just be speculation?
Right. And it wasn't even a strong strangulation case, to be honest with you. The medical science wasn't conclusive that it was strangulation either. You had the prosecutors using an informant who clearly was trying to make a deal with the state to get leniency in his cases. So you had a weak case to begin with. And then the whole medical basis for the case falls apart. And the state's expert comes forward and says, yeah, this is not strangulation. This is methamphetamine. And so at that point, the state has a choice. And what the state chose to do was to say, never mind strangulation. we're going to go on this alternate theory that never was really introduced to the jury, for which there's no physical evidence. There's no puncture marks evidently on the corpse. And we're going to basically make the argument to a judge. And we're going to tell the judge, look, the values of certainty and finality here are important. And we think you should endorse this conviction, endorse this sentence, and it places McKim and his advocates and his attorneys in a difficult position. He has to essentially convince a judge that no other possible alternative is available except for this methamphetamine overdose. And it's been a universal rejection of the arguments for Jesse McKim, so much so that now he's asking the governor of the state for some sort of relief or some sort of mercy.
What's the option for Jesse? It sounds like the door is pretty much closed in the legal system, amazingly enough, but there's clemency, I suppose.
Right. We wisely vested, pardon powers, clemency powers in the office of the governor for this very situation where the system fails and injustice has been done so that the governor, in his good wisdom, can correct it.
Any idea when, Jennifer?
No, there's no deadlines. I know the governor's busy. Hopefully before Jesse dies in prison like his co-defendant already did.
Jennifer Bukowski is an attorney in Columbia, Missouri, and Andrew Cohen, senior editor at the Marshall Project and author of Case in Point. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Up
that's something to take with you today. E.J. Greenberg, a listener, tweeted at The Takeaway about his song, Up in Buffalo. There you go. And while the administration thinks about its beloved wall to stop seepage across the southern border, the Buffalo News reports today that Buffalo area dairy farmers say they could use some seepage across the northern border. Trump's first big trade controversy, they say, is dealing with a worldwide milk glut. Prices have been pushed down, leaving farmers scraping by. Canada's dairy industry in recent months made moves that, in essence, closed the border to an important dairy product, President Trump told reporters last Thursday. Canada, what they've done to our dairy farm workers is a disgrace, a disgrace. Every single cow in the region, you may know, has become a much more productive milk maker, more than twice as much milk per year as the same cow four decades ago. Added up, the world is just flooded with milk, a farmer told the Buffalo News, and farmers are drowning in milk. That's all for us today. Give us your take at 877-8MYTAKE or send us a tweet. Thanks to WBFO in Buffalo, New York for having us here today. And we'll be here tomorrow. Drink some milk. Till then, thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org. If you're traveling west to Idaho or north to Old Toronto, I know you'll find your rainbows there. But I found and lost my rainbow, and though I might regret it, it all comes even in the end. Whoa. And still I
PRI, Public Radio International.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here? And maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.